down, spiraling down into the abysses. So this is the first thing. The second thing which beautifully he points out, that what will be the new man like? What will be the new humanity like? So far civilization has been based upon division. She is Mother Diti, who has brought us up through conflict and clash of forces. It was necessary, because thus alone we could grow in a certain part of our soul. Unless there is a clash and conflict, the strength of the soul, the full manhood, does not develop. So man has to face it. But that phase of civilization is being left behind. The mother assures us, and we can take her word for granted, that hopefully the Second World War was the last that saw the worst of the warring instincts of man. It threw up a lot of dehumanization of feelings, of thoughts, which still exist in a certain way, but hopefully it's in the passing phase. For instance, we talk very disdainfully about Hitler's gas chambers, and no doubt one cannot conceive of anything more cruel that human beings could treat with other human beings in such a way. What was his justification? His justification was that they were inferior. The only superior people were the German blood, which was basically, according to him, the Aryan blood. And all other races were inferior, and therefore they had no right to exist. Now, of course, it's horrible. And he called it compassion when he would basically subject human beings to gas chamber. This was his way of showing mercy, that this is a merciful way of killing. I could have done more horrible things. Now, we don't do that, but we have our own mini gas chambers. For instance, we take dogs and cats and animals and subject them to what is called as a painless death, or a more dignified word, putting them to sleep. And we say the same thing. Well, they are a nuisance, they are a problem, so, you know, they should be out. It's the same mindset. Only thing is, it takes place on a scale where we find it acceptable. But the Superman, the new humanity, will be based on the law of oneness. Oneness, unity, harmony, this will be the master word. And naturally, this oneness, unity, harmony cannot come so long as we live in our mental, vital and physical ego. So this is the fundamental thing that Mother and Sri Aurobindo revealed to us. Because at the mental level, we may try to adjust, accommodate, form an association, but always there will be some ideas clashing with other ideas. And as long as there is a clash of ideas, there will be conflict. If nothing else, ideological wars. We know that these ideologues talk about religious wars, but ideological wars have been much worse. I mean, almost they have on the verge of, I mean, some of the dictators who were involved in massive killings, Mao Zedong, for example, if I remember, 25,000 skulls were found buried. And he didn't believe in religion, but he did something on a mini scale what Hitler did. Hitler himself, it was not a religious war. Again, ideological differences. So at the level of the mind, we cannot find really a lasting basis for unity. At the level of the vital, again, we have likes, dislikes, preferences based on things as stupid as one would say, as language, to customs, etc. And one likes to associate more closely with that. I mean, it's so easy, at least in the Indian scene, all that you need to do to win a person in your favor is to speak the language that he is fond of speaking. So immediately the person feels, you're my cousin, you're my countrykin, and the rest follows. And similarly, at the level of the physical, at the level of the vital, we try to associate based on mutual interest. How does that interest me? How will it help me? Etc., etc. And at the level of the physical, though we all know that basic plan of human body is the same, yet there are differences. People find differences of color, of origin, of all kinds of things. And therefore, unity cannot come as long as man lives under these. So the Mother and Sri Aurobindo tell us that to come out of it, two things are needed. Very simple things, or so it seems. One is find the psychic being, and the second is get out of the ego. But it's a whole lifetimes of sadhana, of course, and above all the grace of the mother. But very interestingly, the mother reveals that if you want to know the supramental life, not through books, one obviously, if one reads the books, one doesn't know about it. One only talks about it and one thinks about it. But talking and thinking is not the same as knowing. She says, if you want to have a glimpse of the supramental, not become supramental, not know it by identity, which of course is a long process. She says there are two ways. One is to enter into contact with your psychic being and live from there. The moment one does that, there's a glimpse of what the supramental consciousness is like. She speaks of it very interestingly in the commentaries on Dhammapad. And the second is, if one tries to get rid of the ego, even in a very small way, she says even in the mind, in a small part of the mind, if you try to get rid of the ego, there is an opening. And through that opening, you can get a glimpse of the supramental world. So this is the path that they have shown to us, which we read last time. Today, of course, we continue in a certain sense, but also we discontinue because every time we take up a new subject or a new writing. It's a very special day. Yesterday, 13th January, was Nalini Das' 125th birth anniversary. And we know, he was born in 1889, and this will be the start of the 125th year. And we know that how beautifully he is not only the one of the foremost disciples of Sri Aurobindo, how from the revolutionary days he has been with him. Sri Aurobindo, he says that how his first darshan of Sri Aurobindo was when he went to hear him talk. And he describes that when Lala Lajpat Rai and Bal Pal, they will speak, then you know the word will go, they would roar and it will be leonine, and you know it will go with lakhs of people coming sometimes to hear, and definitely thousands, and they would be roaring like that. But when Sri Aurobindo stood up, there was pin drop silence. And then he describes his voice as gentle, soft, almost feminine. These are Nalini Das' words. It was not assertive, not aggressive, unlike, Lal Bal Pal. It was a voice which had its own sweetness, very gentle, very soft. And yet there would be pin drop silence when he would speak. So he describes his first darshan of Sri Aurobindo during one of these speeches. And then his first interview, when he went with a message of Barinda, when he was with Manik Tola Garden in Murari Pukur, if I am not mistaken, maybe Shyam Pukur, but most likely the former. He goes and conveys the message to Sri Aurobindo that Barinda has asked him to come to the gardens. And all that Sri Aurobindo says is that, no, I have not yet had my lunch and today it won't be possible for me to go. And he says that was my first interview with Sri Aurobindo. And then we know the rest is history. One interesting thing about Nalini Das was that three times he tried to take sannyas. He had that ascetic temperament in him. So first time he wanted to take sannyas, he thought of sannyas, he went out of the house, kept walking and walking and walking, but eventually didn't take for some reason. He says, my soul refused. The second time, when he wanted to take sannyas, become a wandering ascetic, going around the country. So he asked Sri Aurobindo about it. Sri Aurobindo kept quiet. Then after a while, he told him, wait for some time. Why don't you come with me on my lecture tour to Assam? So he accompanied Sri Aurobindo. And he says the second time, it is the Supreme Soul, the Supreme Purusha, the Lord himself who made sure that I didn't take sannyas. So what about the third time? Third time, 1919, Sri Aurobindo gave him a very interesting command. People get all kinds of commands for sadhana and yoga, and we often make a blanket rule about things in our ignorance. But look at what Nalini Das was told. Nalini, go get married and come back. So in 1919, and Sri Aurobindo, and Nalini Das describes it very interestingly. I was marveling at the words when I read them. He says, I was tied to the heaven-kissed thorny hedges of married life. Heaven-kissed thorny hedges. I mean, they are thorny, but kissed by some touch of heaven. And he was married. So from nine, and then he says, third time, it is the universal mother sensing the danger that I would take sannyas. Look what he's saying. The danger was that he could become an ascetic. He's not saying the danger was that I could get married. He says, the danger, sensing the danger, the universal mother, the supreme Prakriti, she made sure that I do not take sannyas, and that was the end of it. From 1919 to 1926, he would go and come back. And then finally, of course, 26 onwards, he stayed at the ashram. It's very interesting that this year, we know in quick succession, I mean, three of three surviving. He had four sons, but one had passed away, I think, a year and a half back, Ranjuda, and the other three in a short span of 6 months. Two of them in a short span of, I think, 2 or 3 weeks. So it's the 125th anniversary of Nalini Daya, and I thought I'll read something from his writings. He is one of those who was blessed by the mother in with such, praised in such high words. In 1967, on his 78th birthday, the mother writes to him, to dear Nalini, en route to supermanhood, or en route to the Superman. And then, of course, with love, affection, and blessings. So he is one of those who is regarded as the one who really understood Sri Aurobindo's teachings, his writings. And at one place, Sri Aurobindo has remarked that if Nalini is not doing my yoga, then who is doing my yoga? When someone had to complain that, you know, something about Nalini Daya, he said, if he's not doing my yoga, then who is doing my yoga? So on this also Pongal day, which is supposed to be a new day, I thought we would read something about the new humanity, because for us, basically Sankranti is a period of transition of the sun, as we know, into Capricorn, Makar. So that's why it is Makar Sankranti. And it's an auspicious day because it's the time when the sun enters into the northern solstices, that is Uttarayan. So from this day, everything is supposed to be auspicious. And that's why it's celebrated in so many ways, so many myths around this particular day. It's a day of, you know, harvest and many other things. Spring starts, winter ends. So it's a very special day. But for us, the only transition that has a meaning is transition from the old humanity to the new humanity. This is our Uttarayan, and this is our Makar Sankranti. So I thought we'll read something on the new humanity, continuing with the theme of the future. Incidentally, this is the when Nalini Das collected works came out in 8 volumes. This is the first essay in the first volume. And the general title is The Coming Race and Other Essays. The New Humanity. The world is in the throes of a new creation, and the pangs of that new birth have made Mother Nature restless. So look at the prophetic, deep, penetrating insight right at the beginning, because we often say, why there is so much restlessness? Why there is, you know, so much anguish all over? Of course, the mother has remarked that all this anguish, all this tension is because of the birth pangs of a new world. She said this in 1912, and she said this much later also. We look at the youth so restless, we look at everything so restless, at dizzying pace. Now she says it's just like the chick is being formed inside the egg, and as it grows, it becomes more and more restless to come out. So the great tension we experience today is because humanity is wanting to burst out of the shell and emerge into the freer and vaster air, more luminous ether. So he says that's why the earth is restless. It is no longer a far-off ideal that our imagination struggles to visualize, not a prophecy that yet remains to be fulfilled. It is here and now. So Nalini Daya makes it very clear that it is now. This is the moment for the new humanity. Now, he of course makes it clear what that now means. So we can see that when a lady conceives, she is very happy. It's a wonderful, joyous moment in the home that some new being is going to come. But as she progresses, along with the joy, problems come up. There is, you know, vomiting, there is swelling of the feet, there are all kinds of things. And towards the end, there is actual labor pains. So we can say that golden period when the mother and Sri Aurobindo conceived of the new man was when the idea that there will be a new humanity created a stir of joy. But now slowly, as they are coming closer and closer, humanity is vomiting out all the filth, all the dirt, all the poison that is inside, so that it can be cleansed and become ready to receive the Superman. On the other side, there is a greater and greater restlessness, because that something wants to burst out of the shell. Although we may not know it, the new man, the divine race of humanity, is already among us. So what is that now? not after 100 years. He is saying he is already among us. He is there. It may be our next door neighbor. It is such a beautiful thought to remember. When I read it, I was reminded of a little story that in a monastery, people were fighting. Fighting so much that ultimately, you know, people stopped coming to that monastery. There were ultimately only 4 monks left who were fighting with each other. So the head monk, you know, didn't know what to do. So he called the abbot, chief abbot, and said, "Sir, this is the situation. Everybody is fighting. How to control?" He said, "Oh, this is very simple." So he just called each of them separately, spoke to them, and went away. Suddenly from next day, there was a change. And slowly, slowly, they stopped fighting. And each one is wondering why he is not getting angry and why this is happening. And slowly, people started coming. Again, the monastery prospered. Everything went off very well. So the head monk asked the abbot, how did you achieve this miracle? So he said, "Very simple. I just told each one of them, you know, one of you is Christ. Christ is among one of you. Now, you know, there are 4 of them. So they don't know if I offend, this fellow may be Christ. So everybody is in the bargain, becoming nice to everyone. This is the miracle. And how miracles happen? They happen through an inner change. Another Zen story where one fellow following a certain cult asked another monk, "What miracle happens in your place? What miracles can you do?" "My master does the miracle that he stands on one shore with a pen in his hand, and the disciple stands on the other shore of the river with a paper in his hand. And as my master writes in the air, the letters come on the paper of the disciple on the other shore. So can you do some miracle?" He says, "The only miracle I can do is I eat when I am hungry, I sleep when I am sleepy, and when insulted, I forgive." He said, "These are the only 3 miracles that I can do. Other miracles, maybe your master can do." It's a very beautiful Zen story. Shows a tremendous, you know, in the first there is lack of greed. He has mastered greed. In the second, he had mastered, human nature and its impulses. And this third, he has mastered the vital. When insulted, he forgives. And the mother says, "This is the step towards supermanhood. By mastery over nature, not by the mind, but by the psychic. Because when we master it by the mind, nature begins to become harsh, whereas cold, indifferent. But when we master by the psychic, nature blossoms like a little Krishna growing into its adulthood." So this is the first step towards superhumanity. He says it may be in our next neighbor, in our nearest brother. And then he says, even in myself. It's such a beautiful thought that maybe within me, the superman is trying to take birth. Not in an egoistic sense, but in the sense that the divine is forming something in my own depths. And how beautiful if I can participate in that. It marches just behind the line. On the surface, there is all this chaos, fight, hatred, fear, distrust. But right behind the line, there is the superhumanity of tomorrow waiting to be born. It waits, a veil covers it. It waits for an occasion to throw off the veil and place itself in the forefront. And that occasion comes in so many ways. Every time that, for instance, we are insulted, what is the step we take? How do we react to it, respond to it? We become sworn enemies for life. That is the old humanity. So whenever there is a noble impulse, whenever something that rises beyond the ego self and its limited personality, that time the superhuman has stepped out and looked outside through the veil. Every time there is a compassion, not just for our relatives, but not only for humanity, but for the entire creation. How beautifully, 2 episodes I was reading in Pooja Lalji's reminiscences, that when he would go to clean Sri Aurobindo's room. So one is when mother told him, in the name of Sri Aurobindo, go quietly, do not disturb whom? The little sparrow that is sitting. And he was cautious. He went inside, saw the little sparrow, motionless sitting inside. I was just wondering how a sparrow could sit like this. And then he says, at night the master, while taking his stroll, must have noticed it. And he remembered to make sure that we don't disturb that little sparrow. And the other one, he says that when he went, he saw that the cat was sitting, of course, the favorite cat, Bushy, who is immortalized in Sri Aurobindo's Despair on the Staircase. And she was sitting on his chair, as if it's her throne. So Sri Aurobindo goes and sits on the edge so that he doesn't disturb the cat. Such kind of compassion. That reminds me of two more little stories. One from a myth, one from again Sri Aurobindo and the mother's life, how they would deal with humanity. The myth is about Lord Ganesha playing with the cat and twisting the tail, and as usual he doesn't realize that he is hurting the cat. So very soon the game is over and he goes to meet Mother Parvati. Now as he meets Parvati, she sees that she is bruised all over. And then Parvati says, you know, all the pain of the cat has come upon me. We may think it's a myth. The mother recounts that once a wave of illness swept over the ashram. She speaks about it in the context somewhere in the 50s or maybe early 60s. This is after Sri Aurobindo has withdrawn behind the material scene. She says that a wave of illness had spread over the ashram because people were full of ill will, hatred, throwing it at each other. And all this was affecting everybody. And she says, every night, the best time for me was when I would meet Sri Aurobindo and we would discuss about many things, about the material world, about the future. And she says that was the most blissful time, quite obviously. I mean, being amidst all of us and then with the Lord. She said, but that day when I went to meet Sri Aurobindo, he was lying on his bed, sick. He had taken the entire sickness of everybody on himself. And then she says, every time that we throw ill will and hatred, actually the Lord takes it upon himself. I mean, it's such a touching, it's also a gentle remonstrance. And how the Superman deals with earth and its creatures. So Sri Aurobindo clears that notion that it's not the Nietzschean superhumanity with the will to crush others, to destroy all oppositions, to finish off those who oppose, those who conflict, those who contradict. It's not a force, a blind force, but it's a heart of love, of compassion, of wisdom. We are living in strenuous times in which age-long institutions are going down and new forces rearing their heads. Old habits are being cast off and new impulsions acquired. So many institutions, actually the age of institutions is over because all of them were built on an old basis. The mother says that we are living in one of those hours of God when all the old bases are shaken. But what the new mold will be, that we don't know because it has to still evolve. But the old basis, whether it is democracy or thisism or communism or socialism, all that has to go. But what has to come, that will evolve through the course of time. In every sphere of life, we see the urgent demand for a recasting, a fresh valuation of things in every sphere. As we were speaking last week, in religion, in politics, everywhere the change is coming. From the base to the summit, from the economic and political life to the artistic and spiritual, humanity is being shaken to bring out a new expression and articulation. There is the hidden surge of a power, the secret stress of a spirit that can no longer suffer to remain in the shade. So long, the spirit was inside, the soul was hidden deep inside. We had to take it as faith. But now this royalty wants to step out. She is the queen, the bride, who wants to now come out and take charge. When the bride first comes home, that's why Sri Aurobindo actually used the word for psychic being, the bride. In his famous line, earth must transform itself and equal heaven. But for this high spiritual change to be, the heavenly psyche must put off her veil. She is wearing a veil. So when a bride comes to the house, first day she is wearing a veil. Even to look at her, you have to shell out some gift or some money or something. You cannot see her face just like that. But that is only the first day. Then first few days, little bit familiar. Then after a couple of years, she is the boss and the master of the house. Nobody enters without asking the bride because she has become the leader. So also with us, that the heavenly psyche is like a bride, veiled, almost ashamed to step into this kind of our humanness. She is hidden behind. But as time passes, she is now becoming familiar with us and she knows how to change us. So she is beginning to step into nature's front. That power, that spirit has been growing and gathering its strength during all the millenniums that humanity has been through. So all the experience, we are in a way fortunate that all the experience of our past is there in us. So we may think it is forgotten, but no, it is there in us. So that is a big help, and that's why perhaps it is the age of individuality, because now the individualized soul can come out. Before this, it was the age of society. The revolt started, of course, with the Europe in Europe with the age of enlightenment. Then it spread into America, the flower children, and now we have, you know, more and more humanity. Everybody is an individual. And this is a very right step towards discovering the divine essence within oneself. Of course, the next step must complement it, that along with this, there must grow the sense of universality, which is also happening in today's children. Today, the shell is ripe enough to break and to bring out the mature and full-grown being. Another humanity is rising out of the present human species. The beings of the new order are everywhere, and it is they who will soon hold sway over Earth. They are everywhere. They are not just confined to a geographical area. In 1958 itself, Mother made it very clear. She said, now there was a reason why everything was confined here, because there was a work to do. But from in one of her talks in 1958, she says, now it is spread out everywhere, wherever there is an opening. Wherever people are open to the new thought, wherever people are open in some way to Sri Aurobindo and the consciousness he brings, they are disciples. They are part of the ashram, the larger ashram. And Nalida also speaks about the inner ashram, where he says there are many people who are physically here, but not part of the inner ashram. And there are many who are in the inner ashram, but not physically here. Obviously, if there is a choice, it's better to be part of the inner ashram. But best is to be both. That's a great felicity. So, what will this new order of being be like? It will be what man is not, also what man is. So something of man gets transmuted and changes into superhumanity. Whereas certain things in man, the impulse to hate, cruelty, all this will pass away, because that belongs to the complete animal creation. Whereas things which are of a higher nature, love, knowledge, will, that will be taken up and transmuted into something entirely new. It will not be man, because it will overstep the limitations and incapacities inherent in man. Incapacity of knowledge, incapacity of love, incapacity of the will, which stumbles every time. It will be overpassed. And it will be man by the realization of those fundamental aspirations and yearnings that have troubled and consoled the deeper strata. What a beautiful line this is. That have troubled and consoled the deeper strata. Within our souls, the anguish of the soul for a better tomorrow, for a beautiful earth, for a beautiful humanity, for unmixed bliss, for pure truth, for perfect love. All this has troubled the human depths. Because everywhere outside we see its opposite. That's how Sri Aurobindo starts the Life Divine. And he says this presence of the opposite is a sign of a greater harmony to come tomorrow. He says that is the way divine works. Whereas it has also consoled the depths. Because man could retire into his depths and feel the secret presence of that sweet nectar which is hidden inside. So he says all that has troubled and consoled the deeper strata, the soul, in him throughout the varied experiences of his terrestrial life. Our actual ideal of man is that of the cleverest slave. So first distinction is that man so far is a slave. Even when he is master of, say, technology, at push button he can do things. But he is clever, he is still a slave of technology. In fact, he becomes a greater slave, because we know how technology on one side has made our life so easier, so simpler, but also because we have become a generation of constantly, you know, this use of the thumb has gone beyond measure, whether it be mobiles or everything. I mean, we have almost become, new kinds of addictions are coming up. People speak about it. People are no more addicted to alcohol and cigarette, but they are addicted to technology. And they are not comfortable till they have some gadget in their hand and they're playing with it, if nothing else. So this is these are the new challenges. As of now, we are only clever slaves. And this is how we used to value in the old humanity. People were valued by outer designations. How much so and so has studied. Now studying, degree, position is nothing but a question of cleverness. Any clever man with a little bit of brilliance in the mind can achieve things. But his heart may be totally dry and empty. So that created the Asuric kind of humanity where people had big degrees to boot, but an empty heart. So Shobhindu Nalinidas says that is not going to be. But the new man will have found himself and by and according to his inner will, mold and create his world. He will not be a slave. He will know how to deal with the cosmic forces of nature. Even Shobhindu was asked, can we control even the most material forces of nature by our will? He says, yes, it is possible. Though material force is difficult, and yet it is possible. Can we control people, their hatred, etc.? The mother says, the tiger does not attack the yogi. What a powerful thing. That it is possible by an inner mastery to extend that swarat into being a samrat. The cosmic empire, and this is what Shobhindu speaks of, even the Arya, that he is first a swarat and then he is a samrat. By controlling himself, mastery over himself, he masters the universe. But of course, this mastery is not mental. Repeatedly, the mother and Shobhindu remind us, it's not a mental mastery, but the mastery that comes from the sweetness of the soul. We will recognize the new man by his very gait and manner. Look at it. The way he will walk, the way he'll talk, the way he will, his gestures, it will reflect the new humanity. By his certain kingly ease and dominion in every shade of his expression. The old humanity is full of fear. Last time we read that man dealt with the universe as if it is its enemy. And that cult of paranoia has gone to this extent that the next door neighbor is also an enemy. Who knows? Is he? What is he? And we have begun to suspect everybody. But the new man will feel the whole universe is friendly. He will love the universe, and that will begin to change his dealing with the universe. And the universe will begin to yield its deeper rhythms, its secrets. I mean, we have read that day, or rather saw that video of Dr. Hegde, where he talks about how even illness, the courses can be modified. And similar thing I read in Dr. Bunny Siegel's book about the exceptional cancer patients. So what is the difference? He says that when we do an imagery, the old world imagery of fighting with cancer was that the white cells in me are destroying the cancer cells. This was an image. Even I grew up reading that image in the textbooks. He says, but the new imagery, which is more effective, he's done scientific studies on that, is that the white cells are taking the cancer cells and assimilating and dissolving them, as if they become part of the whole total consciousness, and thereby they merge. And that's how the mother says the supramental immunity will work, not by destroying, but changing its nature by taking and assimilating. It may be 100 years down the line, but that is the path that humanity will take. So first he says that he will be a master and not a slave. The next thing, he makes a distinction between, Nalinidas makes a distinction, Shobhindu has made that distinction of course, between two kinds of superhumanity, the Asuric and the Devic type. So Nietzsche, who spoke about Superman, he's, or perhaps Overman, the word can be translated either ways, Superman or Overman. And I think Bertrand Russell is the one who preferred the word Superman, or George Bernard Shaw. In fact, he has written a book also. So he preferred the word Superman, but many preferred the word Overman. It's unfortunate that we have started using that word even in Shobhindu's literature, translating it into Overman. But Nietzsche had done it with a different purpose. According to him, The overman or the superman was a being who was tremendously powerful and strong. And he would destroy, crush those who came. It's almost like an animal aggrandizing himself. So he had that power that he would crush all opposition by use of force. Whereas the devas don't do that. Devas ennoble, take up. I was reading, you know how Sat Prem went away and there was a lot of, you know, people who followed and slowly each one fell out of him. There was a point when he became suspicious even about those who were next to him. This not to belittle the work that he has done. Tremendous work, beautiful work, adventure of consciousness. And of course, the mother's agenda is really a gift. And the mother used his consciousness for this wonderful work. But the other side, that, you know, one of the disciples who fell away from him says very interestingly that always he would speak about this power which was coming down and changing things. And he says, but then I realized the difference between what he speaks and what mother was doing. He says, when you went in his presence, it would be almost, you will feel belittled. There are people, if you go in front of them, you feel belittled, not humbled. Belittled, as if you are small, you are insignificant. Whereas the true divine power sets you free. He said, when you went to the mother and looked into her eyes, you suddenly felt free, vast, as if she was uplifting us to our own highest heights without claiming, possessing, or making us feel like slave. Of course, we would want to be that. As Champak Lal ji said, mother, if I were a chicken, I would like to be slaughtered for you so that you can take the soup. But that is a human aspiration. But the divine would always make, you know, others feel ennobled and great. That's how, you know, so much freedom could be allowed. So he says that the asura, in spite of, or rather because of his aggressive vehemence, betrays a lack of the sovereign power that is calm and at ease and self-sufficient. So we often quote the Gita, but in the Gita, the first step is equanimity, peace, calm. Then the fight is fine. But if we are full of anger, hatred, all this, then it's not the path of the Gita, but an asuric approach. So he says, asura is full of aggressiveness all the time, full of vehemence. The devic power does not assert, but simply accomplishes. The forces of the world act not as an opponent, but as its instrument. So the very things which seem to oppose become the instrument when the Deva nature acts. Thus the new man shall affirm his individual sovereignty and do so to perfection by expressing through it his unity with the cosmic powers, with the infinite Godhead. So in the old man, to deal with the cosmic powers, old humanity had to go to the temples, pray to each power. It was a very long and circuitous route. Sometimes he had to be careful that he does not displease other powers in trying. You know, you go to one temple for 5 years and try to go to some other temple and see what fears come to people. Oh, if this god will be offended. That's how people got at one time hooked to Shani Maharaj. So, you know, Shani Maharaj is not a bad guy. He's a good guy. Actually, his sign is balance. He rendered justice. Only like all judges, he is heartless. So when he rendered justice, there is no feeling inside. But there is a justice. So people started propitiating Shani Maharaj, just like they do to judges, that they want to, you know, make the judges happy. But Shani Maharaj surely doesn't get happy. I'm sure about it, that if he is a cosmic power who rendered justice, he will not listen to propitiations. The human judges may, but Shani Maharaj is not going to do it. But once people started doing it, every Saturday they would put, diya with oil under a tree. I remember suddenly my mother got onto it and I told my mom, why are you doing all this? You worship Lord Rama, what need is all? No, now I have started doing, you know, because somebody had told, I am a little scared. What if, you know, Shani Maharaj gets angry? So, but eventually after turning to mother, all this dropped away. So earlier, that was the way we dealt with the cosmic powers. But now it's not necessary. The age of religions is over. They did a good job. Mostly they were not interested in human affairs. That's how the mother puts it. By the way, they also acted upon human affairs. They had their role. They helped at times. But they're not really much interested in the evolution of earth. They have their role in doing the job. They do it well. But now we don't have to do it. We can directly approach the inner Godhead. What a tremendous liberation. Not only liberation from the animal, not only liberation from the Titan and Asura, But liberation even from the gods, this is the liberation that the mother brings to us, that by uniting with the inner Godhead, we are freed from everything, every cosmic power. Thus the new man shall affirm. And by being some Swarat, self-master, he will become Samrat, world master. Last, and the heart too, which is now the field of passion and egoism, will be cleared of its noise and obscurity. Noise and obscurity. Every time we are hurt, oof, what a clutter, noise it creates. So and so has hurt me, I will show. I will deal, let tomorrow come. I am going to return back. Comment for comment, law of Moses. Eye for an eye. And we wait for the opportunity when we can pass that stinging remark. It's there, it's part of our animal. Animals don't do it in this calculated way. Human beings, because of mentalized, make it worse. But she says that the heart will develop a new law of love, not the law of egoism and obscurity. A serener sky will shed its pure warmth and translucent glow. Of course, this is not the love of a sentimental, romantic kind, where we start crying and enter abysses of despair, or you know, we are excited. It's not that love, but something which carries the glow of an impersonal warmth, like the sun that rises. Everybody feels that the sun has risen today for me, but the sun has not risen for anybody in particular. And yet each one, depending on his capacity, receives the closeness of the sun. This is what people felt with Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Their love and grace is for all. But depending upon our openness and receptivity, we receive it. So that will be the supramental love. Not turbidly passionate, but deeply and divinely passionate. Even passionate to the extent of rushing to help, to protect, to succor, but not in a vital ego, but with the through the calm depths and carrying with it the serenity. We will love not merely those to whom we are akin, but God's creatures, one and all. We will love, and with the yearning and hunger of a mortal, not with the yearning and hunger of a mortal. When we love, we want back. So this is the hunger. We want something or the other. But with the wide and intense rasa that lies in the divine identity of souls. So this love will be full of a rasa. It will be intense. It's not a love which is indifferent. At one place, Sri Aurobindo says, love is love and not indifference. But that intensity will not be to demand, to appropriate, to extract, to fill one's hunger and appetites, emotional or otherwise, but a love which is full of a free self-giving to the eternal. That love will be conscious of coming from a divine source and reaching out to the divine in the other person. Because that is what love is in a sense, coming from the divine and reaching out to the divine in another, with the human being simply as an intermediary and instrument. So we'll stop here. Maybe we'll take up a little bit next time and continue further.